Welcome to episode 14 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley. And on today's episode, we welcome back Tim Abbott. And I know you're all thinking, oh boy, another discussion about the Revolutionary War. But no, on this episode, we're going to be discussing open space and land trusts and what we have, how we got here, and what's new and exciting. And this is going to be a fun one. For the listeners, Tim Abbott is the Housatonic Valley Association's Regional Land Conservation and Green Print Director. He's helped nearly three dozen conservation organizations and agencies secure more than $16 million in public and private funding, and that's protected over 10,000 acres of farmlands, woodlands, and other special places here in New England. So basically, he's an open space rock star. So welcome back, Tim. I'm glad you could join us today.
Thank you so much. It's a little embarrassing hearing that litany of bucks and acres, but those are among the measures that folks in my field have for the progress we're making protecting the lands we love. So thank you.
And you're also a member of the U.S. Senator Chris Murphy's Conservation Advisory Council, which is cool.
Yeah, you know, you hang around as long as I have, which is now over a quarter century in this business, and people ask you to join things. So I have, and I'm honored to be part of
that. Good stuff.
This is a fun topic.
No, it's awesome. So it's a big topic, and obviously a topic of great interest for many of us here in the Northwest Corner. So talk us through why our region is so important, and when it comes to the environment and the nature narratives.
You know, people have been appreciating and fascinated by the nature of our region for at least 150 years of nature writing. I'm sure they loved it for reasons before that, but we can trace it back to after the Civil War when folk here started to get curious about what it was that made this landscape so appealing. And there's a tradition of naturalists and nature writers in our region, and I broadened it to include the Berkshires and the Weebatuck Valley over in New York as well, that goes back at least that long. It's been fun learning who some of those people are, because not only did they have some very amusing and interesting things to say about lands we now know in a modern context, but they influenced the path of local and regional conservation as well.
So what are some of those titles, and how does that tie in?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. One of the oldest was written by a couple of folk who grew up over in Amenia, New York, and in fact at Troutbeck on the Weebatuck. And the last name of the family was Benton. Anybody who knows Benton Hill and Sharon or the Fen up there, that's the same family. And these two young men decided in the, I think, 1870s, early 1880s, to take a wooden boat and go on an adventure. And they made their way all the way to Bull's Bridge on the Weebatuck, which I have done a portion of in a canoe. It took me 8 hours to get from Leedsville in Amenia to the confluence with the 10 Mile because of trees and things across it. But what an adventure. And then they wrote about it. And they weren't quite like Mark Twain and Tom Sawyer, but they camped on the side of the riverbank. They saw wildlife. They suddenly saw this world that they had lived next to, but which they had not been immersed in or fully appreciated until they decided to see what was downstream. And it's that kind of curious, adventurous spirit that I'm talking about. Those guys ended up being really close friends with pretty significant naturalists of the era, John Burroughs being one. And it came from this intense local experience.
Wow. So what else?
Here's another one.
I can totally see that. I mean, we like you, I enjoy the great outdoors. So what else it ties into that?
In the 1910s and up into World War I, there was a writer named Walter Pritchard Eaton who had a cabin up off of Undermountain Road in Sheffield, Mass., just below Berkshire School. He was, as many of the people who wrote in this area, he had work elsewhere. He commuted up from the city, and imagine that commute by train at that time. But he was writing not just really insightful and thoughtful observations of the wildlife and the field life that he saw around him, but of a changing landscape, one where he was starting to see automobiles, one where he was thinking about the the great calamity of the European war that was so far away from that pastoral vision he had from his cabin side. And so there's a sense of being both apart from and a part of a changing world and the kind of things that he wrote. If you get to the 1950s, of course, it's Hal Borland with his little farm on Wheatog Road in Salisbury, looking out at the Housatonic, this hill, this valley, being a classic of nature writing. And again, there was that sense of observing the timed events of the season, of what the slower pace of rural life was giving way to. And these were all people who were very aware of the changeability of the landscape they were observing, and it prompted them to write about it, and it prompted other people to try to preserve it.
Now that makes a lot of sense. You know, I grew up in Reading, which is just down below, about an hour and a half, and Stuart Chase in my town was doing the same thing, and he kind of started around the 20s and 30s, and then he kept on banging that drum all the way through the 60s. So I understand that. That's something that was important to the beginning. What's the tie-in with Jim Buckley?
Well, wonderful for bringing him up, because he's a great example of someone who got that spark as a young man and carried it forward profoundly into his public life. I like to remind my friends who trend further to the right politically than I do that conservation and conservative share the same root and some of the same values, and that's absolutely true. One of which is that, you know, it's better to live on the interest than the principal of your investment. And Jim Buckley, brother of William F., grew up in Sharon, you know, was an intensely conservative person politically. He, in fact, was a New York senator in the United States Senate for the Conservative Party, and yet a champion of the Endangered Species Act, a defender in writing of a tiny little fish called the snail darter that was threatened by a hydroelectric dam out west. And he made the case that it was in line with conservative principles to keep, save, and preserve the natural world, which had intrinsic value. And where did he get that sense of the importance of nature? Mucking around in swamps. He went to Millbrook School, which coincidentally is also where I grew up, just over the line there in town of Stamford and town of Washington. And
no, it's
Millbrook.
Great. I mean, when my kids were growing up, I loved Millbrook School because of the
zoo,
you know, the Trevor Zoo,
Frank Trevor Zoo, right?
When you're a dad that was suffering through a long day, you're like, hey, let's go to the zoo, and it was great. You're right. You're right. Millbrook is a big swamp.
It's a big swamp. It's part of a tributary of Wasaic Creek that eventually finds its way to the 10 Mile and then bends out of New York and back into the Housatonic Valley here in northwest Connecticut. But it was that connection to place and connection to nature that, again, excited his curiosity, helped develop that sense that you can be a fiscally conservative person who doesn't think that big government is important, and yet who also feels that there is a function for government to safeguard things that are part of the public good. What a wonderful and novel idea, right?
But it's also what underlies
land trusts, because the conservation organization that I work for started in 1941, and it started as a regional planning effort by someone who said, you know, I love fishing up there in Cornwall, and it's not going to stay that way unless we're more thoughtful collectively about how we grow and develop and what we set aside. And it came from that. It got a real boost in the 70s at the same time of the Endangered Species Act when local citizens started looking around and saying, gosh, there are some killer threats that are coming to our area now that if we don't band together, we'll, you know, forever change what we love about it. And I'll give you two examples. One was an interstate highway, Super 7, right? Can you imagine? Four lanes divided, plowing their way up through northwest Connecticut and the Berkshires to Vermont. But that's what was planned. In fact, if you drive over the state line from where I live in North Canaan, you're on two lanes of that four-lane highway in Sheffield. And it could have been that. A couple of things slowed it down. One, huge flooding in the 1950s from those hurricanes that gutted the Naugatuck and Housatonic Valleys and made flood control dams more of a priority. But second, was a grassroots group called BLEC, great name, B-L-E-C. And Berkshire Litchfield Environmental Council looked across state lines, said water doesn't care, wildlife don't care, we need to be able to care across that, and raised major objections to the destruction that that development would have brought. To some degree, without an interstate, you know, we had a slower pace of growth as a result, which gave us more time to conserve what we have.
I get it. I mean, we have the same issues down where I grew up.
Exactly. And the closer you get to those places that have easier commutes to major centers, the more carved up the landscape becomes, the more under threat. But there was another one up here, too, and it was an idea for a massive hydroelectric scheme on the top of two major mountains, one of which is Great Mountain in Norfolk, and Canaan, which, again, was one of those places which was preserved because back in the 1910s and 20s, a couple of families looked around and said, where'd all the birds go? You know, why don't we have any ability to hunt ducks anymore? And the answer is they went to Women's Hats, and organizations like, you know, the National Audubon Society and others formed to end the precipitous decline of water birds that were going into the millinery trade. But it was also possible to buy relatively inexpensive uplands that had been cut over for charcoal, if you remember that episode a few episodes ago, for $10 an acre. And they decided, let's build some ponds. Let's try and get that going again. They amassed thousands and thousands of acres up there, which are now Great Mountain Forest. Well, imagine that underwater, the way that Candlewood Lake is, for a pump storage facility that would have then also completely flooded and destroyed Robin Swamp down below, the largest inland wetland in the state. That's what was on the table, as well as another one on Mount Riga in Salisbury. And you know, organizations like BLEC, these grassroots, civic-minded, environmentally conscious folks, were able to raise enough noise to put a stop to that ill-conceived development. From that came fertile ground for land trusts, of which we are blessed with dozens in Northwest Connecticut, to carry on the work of permanently conserving, either through outright ownership or through conservation easements, some of these really important places.
So HVA is around that same time period?
Yeah, the 1940s is when we started. By the 1960s, we were a planning organization that was really helping people to do thoughtful development with meaningful conservation. I know an experience that you had growing up in Reading as well, right? Which would be to conserve the rest.
It was discussed, and there was planning, and the conservation commissions at that moment were really pushing the local governments to consider it. And then around the, I'd say, 64-ish, started to see the traction of preserving land. And then by the late 60s and early 70s, there were federal grants, and we got lucky. In my hometown, they had rock stars for writers, and they got grant after grant after grant.
Sure.
And I believe there's two brothers named Hill who helped formulate the language for PA 490.
Sure.
So it just was a perfect storm of the right people at the right time with the funding that they needed.
You asked at the very beginning, what is it that makes this area so special? And I avoided that by telling you that lots of people have felt that for 150 years. But the end result is that there is this incredible convergence of conservation value, as opposed to dollar value, which there's also, in our region. And it comes from a mixture of things. We have some of the largest intact forest systems in the state. Top of Mount Riga, the Taconic Plateau going up into Massachusetts and over to eastern New York is one. I just mentioned Great Mountain Forest is another. And they're linked by a network of habitat corridors that if you zoom out and take sort of a satellite view, you can see this swath of green running from the lower Hudson Valley all the way up through western New England and eastern New York to the Adirondacks in Canada. And it's a climate corridor of tremendous significance that a bunch of us are working on now, in a program called Follow the Forest, protecting and connecting those linkages. There's a tremendous amount of important farmland soil, both in our valleys. This is all glacial deposits, right? But either in our valley areas, like you see in Salisbury, for example, or on some of the ridges of really good sandy loam that the glaciers sort of smeared in a northwest-southeast direction in the central and southern part of the county. That's really important as well, not just for food and fiber, but because of the other benefits that, that farmland provides. And then water. Drinking water, as pure as it comes because of the filtration it has, incredible diversity of species that are found here, both aquatic and terrestrial, and outstanding world-class recreation opportunities from the Appalachian Trail to our state park system to trails maintained by municipalities and land trusts. If you put all that together, it's sort of outsized conservation importance. And then if you
that's kind of what makes this place special.
Yes.
I think I didn't coin it, someone else did, but I liked it because he called us a pocket Vermont. Mm. And he explained it by saying that we have everything that Vermont has, but we're closer to New York, so that's why he was here. And it makes sense because we are, to a degree, just like a small Vermont town.
Well, you're right. And, of course, in that statement comes both a blessing and perhaps a challenge. We are quite close to major metropolitan areas. The ability now to telecommute has converted a lot of second homes to primary residences. That, we all are familiar with, has brought benefits and challenges for affordability and for livability in our region. But it also means we don't face a certain future, right, of it staying the way we love or retaining its values unless we're deliberate about it. If you just said, let's protect 30% of Connecticut by 2030, take the Biden administration's current goal, we're already above that in many of our towns here, and we wouldn't necessarily feel like we had safeguarded everything that was important because it's just a different concentration of conservation resources and values here.
Yeah,
but
no,
we do have to sort of think, how are we
going to
do that?
I mean, it makes sense because of why people are here and what we can do, and I applaud the current governor's staff for recognizing that with this latest push for the state parks. Obviously, we're blessed with plenty of them. Outdoor activities we all fell in love with, once again, because of the pandemic.
Right.
So it's a really, really good theme. And we have so much to do here in the northwest corner that ties into that. I mean, you can do everything you want here when it comes to outdoor activities. I mean, you can snowshoe, you can hike.
A ski jump?
Bike,
I mean, think about it. All kinds
boat,
of things.
You can ski, you can da-da-da. You know, there's so much here, and every single town in the area has something special that is a draw. I mean, think about Salisbury now with the ski jumps. It's like 98 years. Like, that's the coolest thing I ever found. And the only reason why I knew it was there was because some of my friends were volunteering. And I said, what's that
sure.
all about? And they said, well, it happens every year in the first weekend of February. I said, all right. And you went, and you're like, good Lord, this is amazing. And that every town has something that that has that.
I think it's important to underscore that we're not talking about an either-or situation, right? We live here. This is home for us. This is also home for wildlife. This is also a place that we can't see ourselves as utterly apart from. You know, we don't go about our business independent of the air we breathe or the lands we move through. But that means we need a both-and approach. Nobody is locking up land irregardless of where people need to live. Nobody is saying you can't have affordable housing if you have protected open space. It means we have to be smart about it, right? It means we have to have integrated plans. Our plans of conservation development shouldn't be written by two different committees and then smushed together. They should be thoughtfully integrated. And if we do that, then we're not pitting, for example, the needs of the salamander that's crossing the road against public safety, right? Because public safety wins. We're always going to take care of ourselves first. Instead, we're saying, how can we have an ability to drive on a road and an important habitat connection between this forest and that vernal pool? We have.
All right,
to have
so that's good. Let me ask you this, because obviously we're doing new information in this series. So the latest victory. Tell me about, what's Wild and Scenic. You know, what's that? What's the core of that, and what's the benefit?
Sure, there are a number of regional and national designations that apply to our area. The Highlands Conservation Act acknowledges a swath of towns here all the way down to Pennsylvania that are of such importance that there's a regional earmark for conservation funding. The Forest Legacy Program identifies half of the state of Connecticut as significant for that federal funding source. And the wild and scenic stretch of the Housatonic River, which is 41, almost 42 miles from the Massachusetts line down to Boardman's Bridge in New Milford, is the latest of those designations. It took decades to achieve, right? Not every river that has admirable qualities gets that designation, and it wouldn't have gotten it without local support. It wouldn't have gotten it without the Housatonic River Commission, without the Housatonic Valley Association, without each of the towns, the seven towns that it passes through, saying, this is important to us, because it's a recognition that, as you were saying before, we have a resource that's shared and important culturally, ecologically, sort of at an outsized level, that runs right through our communities and is worthy of recognition and is worthy of being thoughtful about. That designation was awarded finally at the end of last year. And it means that there is some funding that now comes to the region to help with projects that promote and safeguard those resources. It also means that there's a broader group of people talking about it in a shared way. You know, if I zone one town one way, which we can under home rule, and the town on the other side of the river zones it another way, we're not treating that resource the same. And we should at least be talking about how we are treating it and seeing it as that shared
amenity. Yeah, no, it's been good, and HVA has been an important asset of communication for all our communities up here about that theme. I know Mike Jastrzemski was everything to me in my 10 years about water and culverts and water crossing. Him and his team helped that, you know, process for me so well. And then Bill Tingley of the Housatonic River Commission was great. He just kept us all in the loop as to what was happening. And it was a big help to all of my boards to get behind it. And when we needed to provide support, you know, we were there because we knew exactly what the plan was, which was, that's necessary in government.
Well, now you've really hit on what's new part. Because traditionally, things were done at the local administrative level in our region, right? We've got home rule in Connecticut. Each town has a great degree of delegated authority to manage its local affairs, zoning, etc. Some have conservation commissions, some don't. That was the same with land trusts. With the exception of the Housatonic Valley Association and now the Northwest Connecticut Land Conservancy, land trusts around here formed at the town level. And for many years, that's what they looked at. They had so much in common, but they were focused within their own boundaries. We don't do it that way anymore. It is all about collaboration. Collaboration across organizational boundaries, collaboration with partners who aren't just land trusts, collaboration across state lines, public-private partnerships, sharing the kind of capacity and information that really would have been unthinkable without a basis of trust and familiarity that we've built together under the Litchfield Hills Green Print, for example, which I...
I agree. There's no other way to do it. If you don't work together, it doesn't get done. And that's been proven over and over and over again. And so, Tim, I think we're just about out of time here, but thank you so much for sharing your depth of knowledge and the stories, and I look forward to our next talk adventure.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's been fun to dip our toe into this topic. There's a lot more to it. Look up Walter Pritchard Eatman's in Berkshire Hills or Hal Borland's This Hill, This Valley. Those reads will be very rewarding.
Awesome. All right. Thanks again, Tim.
Thank you, my
friend.
Now,
in the next episode, we'll be talking about how travel through swamps and other wetlands were made possible by something now referred to as a corduroy road. And it's also even better because we had a very exciting find locally here in Sharon when we were replacing a drain pipe on West Cornwall Road. So I'll share that with you next time. And until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information with Brent Colley is produced at the studios of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.